Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, it may well have been the most important speech of his very long political career. All eyes were on U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday as he delivered his State of the Union address with concerns about his suitability to run for another four-year term. People from across the political spectrum tuned in to hear a familiar playlist, but could he hit the right notes? Did he? We find out. Many Canadians are just a month away from witnessing one of nature's most spectacular events, Canada's first total solar eclipse in more than 40 years. The eclipse path of totality will stretch from southern Ontario and Quebec into Atlantic Canada. It could be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see one. We preview where and how best to watch it. Should you consider getting a divorce, a sleep divorce, that is? It's a trend of couples choosing to sleep in separate beds despite living under the same roof. What are the pros? What are the cons? I speak to a sleep medicine specialist to find out. But first, if you've ever suspected we Canadians pay a lot more in bank fees than others, a new study from North Economics dug into the topic and found out that we do. Comparing fees headed as five big banks with what customers pay in the UK and Australia, what did they find? Well, they claim that we pay much more a month for all number of things, a lot more. Why? And what can you do to push back and maybe save some money? This is something that everybody gets annoyed with in this country. If you've ever lived abroad, you may be familiar with the fact that you often pay lower banking fees. I lived in the UK for a while, and it took me a while to stop trying to find my own bank to go to the bank machine, because in Britain, you can go to any bank machine you want. You don't pay anymore, right? So it took, you know, having grown up here, you're always looking for your bank if you need to take out cash. Well, there's a new study out from the consultancy North Economics in Alberta that's dug into this topic, comparing fees at Canada's five big banks, so RBC, TD, BMO, CIBC, and Scotiabank, with what customers pay in the UK and Australia. So relatively comparable. The UK, not quite as much. It's much more densely populated, obviously, and more competitive. But the UK and Australia, what did they find? Well, they claim that we as Canadians pay much more per month for all number of things, including bank accounts, overdraft, ATM fees at competitor banks. The list goes on. By their calculations, and by their calculations, I should preface this by saying it's theirs, Canada's five biggest banks had $7.73 billion in excess income, about $250 per Canadian. Now, the Canadian Banking Association, of course, disputes this and says, listen, you know, we give you good value for money, right? But as the author put it, Canadian banks have done a very good job of extracting as many fees out of us as possible. Joining me now with more on this, as well as how you can try to avoid these fees or as much as humanly possible, is personal finance journalist Rubina Ahmed Haque. She's host of the personal of the show For What It's Worth on the Chorus Radio Network. Rubina, thanks for your time tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I suppose for those who've lived elsewhere, and this applies to a couple of different industries in this country, but you do notice fairly quickly that your bank fees are noticeably lower in a place like Britain, for instance.
And you have more access to machines without worrying about cost. So it's not even just your bank charging you to hold your money and if you don't have a certain balance. I know when I lived in England, I could go from Barclays to HSBC to wherever I wanted to. And there was no fee to take money from another bank machine, even though you banked with somewhere else. And so I've always been pretty annoyed with the fact that the big banks here in Canada don't allow that. Because I can understand if you go into a teller and you provide that, you know, you get that service from another person, but with an ATM, they should provide those services for free, and all the other fees that they take from you, they add up and they can really hurt someone's bottom line.
Yeah, I loved one of the findings in this report. Canadian banks have done a very good job of extracting as many fees out of people as possible. And I thought, oh, that draws a line under it.
Yeah, exactly. And fees that have nothing to do with the interest on the money or the investments they've made with your money. These are, you know, above that line. So they're pure cash grabs, as some people might call them, because people make mistakes when they're managing their bank accounts.
Yeah. Why is that? I mean, I think we have an idea as to why, but why would it that why would our system be quite different? I mean, I suppose we could talk about the US, but this one compared the UK and Australia specifically. Why is it so different here?
So part of the reason is, again, lack of competition. So there's less customers. Like, banks are businesses. People often forget they're not services, they're businesses, even though they're called financial services. They're in there to make money. And there's not as many customers in Canada, so they're not able to provide as many freebies, as you might want to call them, because they can't. They say they can't afford to do so. The thing that's frustrating is most of these fees are taken up by people who are already in low-income situations. So they can't afford to carry a $3,000 to $5,000 balance in their bank account in order to waive all fees. They're more likely to go into overdraft. So they pay a fee for that, and they pay interest on the money that they went into overdraft. And they're more likely to take on more expensive loans because they don't have a house, for example, to take a home equity line of credit, which is one of the cheapest ways to borrow money quickly. It's only prime plus 0.5, as opposed to an unsecured line of credit, which is much more expensive. So these things can be really annoying. That it again, you know, even though it's 250 per Canadian, this report came out with, on average, I would assume that most of that is tilted towards lower income Canadians, because they're the ones who are always living on the edge of their finances.
Yeah, just so listeners understand, it's the report found that it looked at sort of retail banking profits to deposits ratio for 2022. So I don't know if that is exactly a fair comparison, but it found that Canada's five biggest banks had $7.73 billion in excess income, which works out, as Rubina was pointing out, to about $250 per Canadian. It's interesting to see, though, when you sort of put it down on paper and look at what the Aussies do and what's done in Britain, just about things like, you know, non-sufficient fund charges, how much higher they are here. Now, there are other things that are higher there, to be fair, but it's just little things like that. Like, they really ding you when you make a mistake in this country.
They do. I mean, you can pay, you know, up to $10 if you go into overdraft, because 1 month your account was below zero for a day, you know. So that's the other thing that can be really annoying, is that maybe you miscalculated, you didn't do your math properly, and for one day your account dipped below zero, but you're able to get the money back in quickly. It's also frustrating when you have several accounts with a bank and one account happens to go below a threshold, and they ding you on that. They don't really look at your entire profile and say, oh, this person's trying to do what we always tell them to do: save money in this account, have this account as your, you know, where all the cash, the bills are flowing in and out of, are being paid in and out of. And because they're doing that, if we're digging them because this one account goes lower, whereas if you see them as one profile, they've actually got more than enough money in the bank to deserve having all fees waived. You know, if Australia can do it, being a very comparable nation when it comes to population, there is no reason why Canadian banks can't do it as well. I think it's going to come from government. It has to come from some sort of incentive from Ottawa to make banks create a situation where we pay less fees.
Yeah, although they've been talking about it for years. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've covered, I mean, election campaigns where this came up. I think the finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, has talked about it recently as well. They know that this is something that Canadians would like to see, and yet they seem to have been relatively powerless to make it happen. By the way, I should mention, in fairness, that, you know, the Canadian Bankers Association says that, you know, that our country's competitive banking system provides good value, right? I mean, they defend this. But government has been talking about this for ages in terms of trying to get this done, because they know people care.
Yes, they know people care. I mean, in the banking, not that I love giving the banks compliments, I mean, our banking system is one of the strongest in the world. And if you compare it to the United States, much stronger, even the UK. We don't have these smaller banks that are more at risk of defaulting or not running out of money for you to get out of the ATM. You'll remember Silicon Valley Bank last year, the run on the banks that happened there, when people just got a whiff that maybe the bank was going to default and maybe they were going to run out of cash. And so many people went and tried to withdraw their funds all at once. And so we don't have that kind of issue. That's never happened with any of the big banks, even the smaller ones. There are options, no fee banking. I mean, we know all about them. They're all online banks. The only issue with that is that they do have some restrictions. I myself have a no fee bank account, along with a bank an account with a bigger commercial bank. And I have found sometimes there are some roadblocks to get past when there's a more than a complicated issue of just putting money in and taking it out.
Rubina Ahmed Hawk is with us this half hour. She is a personal finance journalist and host of For What It's Worth on the Chorus Radio Network. We're talking about bank fees. A new study by a group called North Economics, a consultancy in Alberta, has found that Canada's big five banks, compared to the UK and Australia, that consumers pay a lot more for their services. We pay a lot more for their services. If you've lived in one of those two countries, as I lived in Britain for a while, as did Rubina, you'll know that. It's just, I mean, ATMs is the perfect example. When you go to the bank machine in Britain, you don't have to worry about what bank machine you're going to because you're not charged for it. Whereas here, I mean, it can really add up. You get the Interac charge, you get the charge for your own bank. It can get really expensive. None of that exists in Britain. There are reasons why. I think the Canadian Bankers Association defends the way they do business here. Rubina, I know we've had this conversation before. I think part of the problem here too is just our own laziness. We don't shop around much when it comes to banks, probably because we don't think there's many. They're all the same. But there is ways to kind of try to avoid some of these fees, or at least have them be as low as possible.
Of course, I think shopping around is always smart. Whether it has to do with opening a bank account or for anything really, you should make sure understand the market before you sign up. A lot of us just do everything at one bank, and that may also be a problem because we may not be getting best value out of what we're actually asking the bank for. For example, most of us just get a mortgage at the bank where we have our savings and checkings account. That may not be the case. I mean, you can shop around at other banks and get a mortgage somewhere else, but we get very loyal to our banks when they're not necessarily loyal to us. Small things that we do is that we don't plan ahead when it comes to taking cash out of a bank. So like you said, you go to a bank machine that is not your bank machine, and there's like several fees that are charged, which is another criticism this report brought up. It's that it's not just the bank that you're using that's charging you, it's your own bank, which makes less sense as to why they would charge you. And then there's that go-between Interac that they charge you as well. And so, according to this report, up to $9 you can pay for a small transaction. Imagine thinking of $40 and having paying $9 for that privilege. And also those other machines that you get will often find at retail establishments or events or bars where they are just bank machines. They're not affiliated with any financial institution. They cost a lot of money too. But yeah, to your point, you definitely should shop around. Again, banks are businesses and they are selling you a product. They're selling you a checking account. They're selling you a credit card. They're selling you a mortgage. If we change our thinking about the way financial services work, we'll be a lot more careful when we sign up for a credit card or do other things that affect our finances.
Yeah, and there is leeway too. I mean, again, as you pointed out earlier, those with the least amount of money in a bank account tend to be treated the worst, which is unfortunate, right? Because it's those who can least afford it end up getting saddled with a lot of these fees. But you can push back a little bit too. I mean, ostensibly, you can try to get your bank, the bank that you deal with, to try and cut you the best deal possible. I know that sounds a bit odd, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, especially if you've been a loyal customer for many years, or in some cases many decades. Say you opened an account when you were a kid, and now you're in your 30s, and you want to get an account with no fees, and they're giving you a bit of pushback. You can use that loyalty piece to really show them that you're with them because you've really enjoyed being their customer. They'll give you options for sure. I mean, sometimes the one account that they're showing you is not the one that you need. If you've been to a teller recently, they're always trying to upsell you stuff. Oh, did you know you could get this account or that account? Do all these other
Yeah,
things. And
it's
so you
like going
don't
to a
really
shoe
need that
store. It's
stuff.
like going to a shoe store now. Do you want some polish with this? You're like, no, thanks. I'm good.
Ben, one thing that anybody who knows me will know is that I hate the upsell. The upsell is one of my pet peeves. You buy something, they want to sell you insurance. You buy
Yeah.
something, they want to sell you
They're forced to
the
do it though,
extra.
right? Like they're told you have to do this, right?
I do feel for the customer salesperson because sometimes commission and bonuses are tied to how much they can sell that extra stuff. But I really wish that in as a society we would get rid of that because if I want to give charity, I'll do it in my own way. The other day I bought shoes and he wanted to sell me these grippy things at the bottom that would keep my. I'm like, why don't you just put those on the shoe to begin with? Why do you have to sell them to me? Why are these shoes slippery? Aren't they unsafe then?
What are you telling
So
me here?
exactly. So the same thing with the banks. It's like when you go in, they're not really being your friend. They're really just trying to sell you a product.
What about stuff like credit unions and so on? Is there any advantage to exploring that?
They are, and credit unions, much like online banks, can sometimes have some. Not, I wouldn't say restrictions. That's not the right word. They can have. There's. They don't have all the services that the big banks have. And the number one problem is that they don't have as much exposure. So you wouldn't be able to walk into a credit union maybe that you deal with in your neighborhood halfway across the country. Whereas if you're a customer of CIBC, you can easily whether you're in Vancouver or Halifax, it doesn't matter. You can walk in and get the same kind of service because they are your bank. So credit unions are great. I know a lot of our older listeners do like credit unions. They often offer products at better interest rates on either end, investment and mortgages. But you need to know what their parameters are so that you can work within them.
Well, Rubina, as always, thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Have you ever heard of something called a sleep divorce? I know it sounds a bit harsh, but here's TV personality Carson Daly.
I was served my sleep divorce papers a few years ago. and it's the best thing that ever happened to us. We both admittedly slept better apart.
Yeah.
But now we've reconciled a little bit, so we're just sleep separated. So sometimes I'm in the bed, sometimes I'm on the couch or in the guest room.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds harsh, a sleep divorce, right? But getting a good night's sleep is so important. It can be very elusive. What keeps us up, right? I mean, I can list the ways, the reasons I stay up at night, stress. I mean, some people suffer from chronic pain. It's tough to sleep. There's noise. There's time. And sometimes it's your partner or in some cases, you for your partner. And that's led to more and more conversations about something called sleep divorce. Now, again, it sounds a bit extreme, but it really is just the practice of couples sleeping in different beds or different rooms to make sure they each get a good night's sleep. It doesn't always have to be permanent, obviously, but it can help in the short term. Recognizing when and why you're not getting enough sleep is probably essential for your health, and investing in that kind of thing could really help your relationship in some cases, but you need to know more about it. So we're going to find out. Of course, this is a weekend where there will be a lot of talk about sleep disruption. Most of us will wind our clocks forward, you know, spring forward, fall back, spring forward, an hour overnight, Saturday into Sunday. University of Calgary psychology professor Michael Antle says the time change isn't just about losing an hour of sleep. It causes social jet lag.
So what daylight savings time does to us is it forces us to get up an hour earlier than our body is ready. And it's going to do this every day until dawn gets to a point when we start feeling better. When there's a mismatch between what your body clock wants to do, and it's following the sun, and what your boss or your teacher expects you to do as far as being at your desk.
There you have it. I mean, and we all know that feeling, right? Like come Monday, everyone's just a little out of whack. I think it's worse in the fall than it is in the spring still. I mean, again, most provinces, as well as Nunavut and the Northwest Territories, will move their clocks ahead 1 hour on early Sunday. Yukon and most of Saskatchewan keep their clocks the same year round. And some sleep experts really feel like we should all be like Yukon in parts of Saskatchewan. They're again calling for an end to these seasonal time changes. More and more safety or research on safety suggests that daylight savings time can have a dangerous and serious effect on health and safety. Dr. Jocelyn Chang is vice chair of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine's Public Safety Committee, and she joins me now. Dr. Chang, thank you.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, we wouldn't be able to talk about today if we didn't talk about daylight savings time and your business, because I know this is when you get all these phone calls. But we're heading back into daylight savings time again this weekend, and I gather just from your point of view, I mean, this is something that kind of disrupts all our sleep patterns.
That's absolutely correct. And it's not a particularly controversial point of view in general within the medical community, because all of the standing evidence, or at least the preponderance of it, seems to demonstrate that, if anything, going into daylight savings time has adverse health effects on us. And we know that physiologically, our circadian rhythm or biological clock is attuned to being exposed to lots of light in the morning and less light in the evening. But starting this Sunday, we're going to be exposed to the opposite of that. We're going to have less light in the morning, which is when we need it, and more light in the evening, which is against our biological clock.
Yeah. You've even advocated as an organization for doing away with it, right?
That's correct. We support actually a permanent standard time. Permanent meaning no seasonal time changes whatsoever. And we would advocate for that because it is difficult for the body to adjust and readjust two times a year. But beyond that, to standard time, because it aligns with our biological rhythm.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, I mean, this has kind of circulated politically for a long time. It doesn't seem like they can ever get their act together on this one, because I guess it has. There's a lot of moving parts to it. Everyone has to agree. But just from the medical community's perspective, this seems like a bit of a no-brainer.
In general, I would say that that is the case. As I mentioned, the preponderance of the evidence really does support a permanent standard time. That's not to say every single study out there has said that, but based on the majority of the evidence that we've seen and the best data that we have, that's certainly the case and supports a permanent standard time.
How should one cope with it from a sleep perspective? How should you adjust to what's about to happen to us Saturday into Sunday?
Well, at The bare minimum, we would want people to allot themselves enough time to get sufficient sleep. And so for most adults, that's approximately 7 hours. Some people can actually get away with less. Some people might need more. But in general, 7 hours is the most important thing to get. Leading up to the time change, however, and now we're only a day and a half away, so it might be a little late for this. But in the days leading up to that time change to daylight savings time, you could move your bedtimes about 15, 20 minutes earlier. And then you can adjust things like meal times, which also provides a cue to your body a little earlier as well. And then obviously the night before, you set your alarm clock at that earlier time. And when you wake up in the morning, as I mentioned, this switch to daylight saving time means that we're exposed to less light in the morning. So it's really important once it happens to get out there and expose yourself to bright light once you wake up.
Right, to get out and enjoy it. And put away those devices, I gather, is another one. I mean, that goes for all times, but put away your devices is sort of even more important on weekends such as this one.
Exactly. In the evening when we're getting more light, more light just doesn't mean outside, but with all the devices that we scroll through when we're having difficulty falling asleep, getting exposed to that bright light from your screen is not going to help you.
What do you do then? I mean, this comes up a lot about how to survive the next day if you haven't had a good night's sleep. I know this was so say you come out of this weekend, it's Monday, you're feeling a little groggy. How do you cope with maybe feeling a little out of sorts sleep-wise? What's the best way to do that? Is it napping during the day if you can, or how does that work?
If you can get away with it, usually a little brief restorative nap of 20 minutes will not interfere with your ability to fall asleep later at night. As I mentioned though, making sure that you're exposed to bright light during the day at all times of the appropriate day is certainly very helpful. If you're active or exercising, that can also wake you up, and it's generally healthy to do that. But it's also important not to do that too close to the time that you go to bed, because that can actually make it harder for you to fall asleep because you're more activated at that time.
Right. I suppose sitting in a dark room and chugging caffeine is probably a bad idea altogether, always.
In general, a little caffeine is probably fine, but as a chronic practice is not recommended.
The reason I had called originally, of course, we knew daylight savings time was coming and we'd talk about this, but I wanted to talk about sleep divorces because, it's a pretty harsh term to use, sleep divorce. A sort of sleep trial separation might be a better way of putting it. But it seems to be something that people are talking about at least more than they used to. Are you seeing more of it?
I am seeing more of it. And it's not necessarily that it's more common. It's perhaps maybe more that it's more culturally acceptable to admit that this is happening now. 50 years ago, 100 years ago in the past, I can't imagine that, people sleeping apart from each other in bed as spouses would have been construed as something that society would accept easily. And I think that now we have sort of a broader perspective on the way that relationships are managed. And so it's great that this is out there in the public. So again, it might not just be that it's occurring more, but that it's just more easily acknowledged.
Yeah, because one of the things that any married couple knows is that sometimes you can love your partner to bits, but sleeping with somebody else, and you've just been talking about the importance of sleep, that sleeping with someone else can be a challenge, right? Especially if you have different schedules and so on, and your sleep is important to you.
Your sleep is very important to you. We know that there's a myriad of bad health effects from poor sleep. Some of them are very obvious to anyone who's ever had insufficient sleep or, had to stay up all night or had it interrupted. Your mood is terrible. Your tolerance level for things is bad. You're not attentive. Just the very obvious ones. But aside from that, we know that there are other chronic effects downstream if this occurs on a routine basis, like ill effects on your cardiovascular health, increased inflammation in your body, poor memory. It interferes with the depth of the sleep that you get. And so that sleep quality can also affect your memory processing and the ability of your brain to clear toxic substances. So yes, it's very important.
Dr. Jocelyn Cheng is with us this half hour. We're talking about sleep, the all-important sleep. She's vice chair of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine's Public Safety Committee. Dr. Cheng, when people come to you, or if you see people that talk about maybe wanting to try this, so under what circumstances would it be Do you sort of recommend that people try, and how does it work?
Well, when somebody comes to you as a physician with this as a problem, I think one of the first things you want to understand is why this is an issue at all. And the reason I bring that up is because sometimes the bed partner or you might be, for instance, snoring, and that can be a sign of having a condition that needs to be treated, right, like obstructive sleep apnea, which is very, very common. So it's really important for us to want to rule things like that out just by taking the history. And, you know, if it's your patient that's coming to you with this and having symptoms and their bed partner's complaining about it, then certainly something that you should work up as a clinician. So after ruling those sorts of things out, assuming everything else is more related to, for instance, people have different schedules or having different time, temperature, preferences, hogging of the covers. I think that we've all been there, all those various things that can interfere with your sleep. Somebody tosses and turns all night and you wake up really, really easily. Those are all good reasons to start having that conversation. And it might be the case that you don't necessarily have to do it every night. As I mentioned, maybe it's a schedule issue. Somebody's work schedule at a certain time is not amenable to the other partner. So maybe that's a time period when they could undergo this quote sleep divorce, or rather just sleeping in separate beds and then join back together when it's not an issue. But even if it's something that's chronic, it's not necessarily pathognomonic of anything in the relationship. It's just important to make sure that both partners are mutually okay with sleeping in separate rooms or in separate beds. And if that's the case, that they also have conversations about, well, when will we be intimate in that way if we don't sleep in the same bed all the time? And again, it's really about having, you know, a mutual conversation and making sure that you're hearing the other person.
Yeah. I know you're not a psychologist, but there's a lot of psychology involved in sleep compatibility, right?
There absolutely is. There absolutely is.
Yeah. And oftentimes, I think sometimes one partner doesn't, if one partner isn't sleeping well, the other one doesn't necessarily understand why that is. It doesn't understand what the anger is. But I read some story about ages ago about sort of snoring and how much it leads to divorce.
Which is not all that surprising. And it's something that's treatable frequently with something called continuous positive airway pressure, which is a device that can be used to prevent or alleviate the obstructive events. And, you know, even in some of those cases, when it's treated, it's still possible that the partner is just not able to sleep with the machine in the room or anything like that. And that's perfectly, you know, reasonable. Everybody has sort of their own tolerance level of what they're able to sleep with and the circumstances of it. So really, the most important part about it is having an open conversation and making sure that the other person understands where you're coming from.
Yeah, I guess the danger here is that the less sleep you get, the more irritable you are. The more irritable you are, the more this becomes a problem. Right?
It does become a vicious cycle. So don't let it just stay there and get worse and worse. It is very important to address.
All right. So Dr. Cheng, thank you so much for your time tonight. And I guess in your case, you went through med school, so you must know what it's like not to sleep too much. But you'll have
I know very much. I mean, you know, between that and call, and my partner is also a physician, so we're on call at different times. We're very used to it.
Oh, wow. So you must have to practice what you preach in some senses as well.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, have a great weekend. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
You know, back when, at least for some cultures, this was considered to be a very ominous sign, but it is one of nature's greatest spectacles. 1 month from today, in fact, it will have passed 1 month from today. So 1 month from today, we'll be talking about it. Canadians in several communities will be able to see the nation's first total solar eclipse in quite some time. There was one that was visible back on August 1st, 2008, but only if you kind of lived in a remote part of Nunavut. And then we have to go all the way back to 1979, I think, February 26th, when perhaps there was some great footage online from Winnipeg back then, because I think Winnipeg got the full total solar eclipse that day on a really cloudless day. So it was kind of a perfect environment. So I was watching some reports of that earlier. The eclipse's path of totality, in which the moon crosses between the sun and the earth in perfect alignment, will stretch from southern Ontario and Quebec to Atlantic Canada, with those seeing the world go into just about darkness. And of course, the cities and towns in the path are reporting some serious interest in watching this, because of course, the thing about eclipses, total eclipses, is that they don't, it's not that they're that infrequent. It's just, they don't happen in the same parts of the world often. So, you know, if it's near home, you might as well go and have a look. So hotel bookings are up. Many are prepping for an influx of people trying to catch a glimpse. Global Sean Preville reported on this a little earlier this week.
As the moon is set to block out the sun during a total solar eclipse on April 8th, Canadian communities are blocking out the date in their calendars as they expect many to arrive in hopes of a glimpse of the celestial event. With that hope comes a need for a place to stay, and Airbnb says they've seen a 300% surge in searches for cities along the path of totality.
There's a huge amount of interest, which, and I think we'll see more and more people booking on Airbnb over the next month.
The popular platform notes as of February 25th, more than 50% of Canadian listings on the eclipse's path were still available. A total solar eclipse occurs when the moon passes between the sun and earth in perfect alignment, completely blocking the sunlight and plunging those in the path of totality into darkness. That path in Canada stretches from parts of southern Ontario and Quebec to Atlantic Canada, with cities like Kingston, Ontario, Montreal, Quebec, and Miramichi, New Brunswick all in the line of sight. The last time the path of a total solar eclipse crossed Canada was in 1979, but it's the first time in nearly 700 years that Kingston has been in this path, and Ashley Bradshaw with Tourism Kingston says excitement is building.
Our hotel partners have been reporting an increase in occupancy as early as fall of 2023, and we do suspect that this will only continue to arise as April 8th. Comes.
It's not just Canada, though, in the path, with Mexico and parts of the U.S. also set to eclipse into darkness. Science journalist Dan Falk will be in Texas and says he hopes many will be able to experience it.
If the weather cooperates, the sky should turn a nice deep blue, like a very deep twilight, and it's like there's a little hole in the sky where the moon is blotting out the sun's light just for a few moments. But it'll be this very eerie kind of surreal phenomenon that's really not like anything else you can see.
Sean Preville of Global News, they're reporting on the total solar eclipse, which will happen on April the 8th. I don't think I've ever seen one, because I think the last one, I grew up in Montreal, so the last one there was in 1972, I believe. Although there was parts of it in 1979. I may have seen partial ones, we probably all have, and lunar eclipses, obviously, but this is a really big deal. The time and duration of the eclipse will really vary depending on where you are. So, for example, Hamilton, 3:18 p.m. local time. It'll last about 2 minutes. Montreal, 3:26. It'll last about a minute and a half. The place to be, well, Miramichi is going to be a good spot in New Brunswick. Sherbrooke, Quebec, east of Montreal, a place that I used to work for a while, will get a whopping 3 minutes and 26 seconds of totality starting at 3:27. So 3:26 starting at 3:27. So lots to look forward to coming up in just a little less than a month now. Kelly Lipo is an education and outreach scientist at the Office of Public Outreach at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, but she knows her Canada well. Kelly, thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
This is, I mean, it's one of those things that you start the people who are really into it, and you refer to yourself as an adult Lisa Simpson, but you know, some folks are really into it and they plan way in advance, and the rest of us start to catch up and think, oh wow, this is going to be a really big deal.
Uh-huh, exactly. Yeah, no, I've been, I was actually very late to make my plans for an astronomer.
But I guess this is like years in advance then sometimes, right?
Exactly, yes. So I only figured out what I was doing in the fall.
So already in the fall. Wow. So where are you off to?
So I'm off to Indianapolis. I'm going to be in the stadium where they have the Indianapolis 500. And I'm going to be helping out with a NASA event there.
Holy moly. So tell me, I mean, one of the things that, that's great, is that, of course, total solar eclipses are not that rare, but once every 18 months, I think. But it really depends on where you are. We really don't, if you live in a certain part of the world, you rarely get a chance to see one.
Exactly, yeah. So about every 6 months, the sun and the moon and the earth get in a line. And during these like 35 days every 6 months, it's an eclipse season where you can have either a solar or lunar eclipse. Lunar eclipses, as you might imagine, are a lot more common. You can see that in about half the Earth. So you'll see a lunar eclipse pretty frequently where you live. But solar eclipses only cover a teeny tiny portion of the Earth, and they're in a different spot every time. So they happen very infrequently in one location.
Right. So, I mean, I think we've explained this a few times, but just so listeners hear it again, what is going on?
So during a solar eclipse, the sun and the moon and the earth are all in a line, and the moon blocks out our view of the sun, and it casts a shadow on the earth. And so it just happens to be there's a coincidence that although the sun is 400 times wider than the moon, it also happens to be 400 times farther away, so the moon right. can completely cover the sun.
Wow. And this is, I mean, Canada, obviously, as you would expect, in Canada, we're talking a lot about what's happening in Canada, but this is happening, as you pointed out, you'll be in Indianapolis, so it's happening in the U.S. and in Mexico as well.
Exactly, yeah. The eclipse starts down in the Pacific Ocean. It goes through Mexico, up through the U.S., cutting across the Great Lakes and then into Canada.
Right. So tell me about, I mean, some of the chatter that's going on in your world about what people are planning for the 8th.
So I guess the key is you have to have clear skies in order to see the eclipse. So a lot of astronomers did a lot of calculations about where is it least likely to be cloudy in April. So I think a lot of people are actually heading to Texas or Mexico. But also there's a lot of excitement about the different science that NASA and other people are doing during the eclipse, and also a lot of citizen science projects as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was thinking back, I was watching a bit of coverage of the 1979 eclipse that Winnipeg was sort of front and center for. And I thought, wow, things have changed when it comes to like citizen science and social media. So much has changed since. Tell me a bit about some of the stuff that's going on around, like some of the scientific things that happen when some of what we like to find out when there's an eclipse.
Yeah, so one thing that you're able to see during a total solar eclipse is the faint atmosphere of the sun, the very faint, wispy outer bits of the sun called the corona. And people who study the sun are interested in that, and we get a very good view of that, better view than we have at any other time during a solar eclipse. So there are both NASA missions, they're sending up rockets into the sky with cameras on them to take pictures. They're sending planes that are going to fly along the path of the eclipse to draw out that eclipse experience as long as possible. And they're also recruiting people all across North America who have cameras or other things to participate in this science.
Yeah. And I can only imagine a lot of those pictures will be shared too, which makes it even, I mean, although, you know, it's always nicer to see it. I'm unfortunately in a part of Canada that's not going to see much of it, maybe a little bit of it. But it's going to be interesting to see all that pops up. What about this NASA event that you're that you're taking part in? What's going on in Indianapolis at the Indy 500 Speedway?
So we're going to have a big viewing party there. And also I'm going to be there to talk a little bit about the science of not only eclipses, but also some of the other astrophysics that NASA is doing. For example, did you know that the James Webb Space Telescope has its own little thing called a coronagraph, and it can block out a star to see the faint things around it? It's sort of like making our own eclipse on demand.
Wow. Well, it's great to have Kelly Lipo with us this half hour. She's an education and outreach scientist at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. We're talking about the total solar eclipse, which is coming up in exactly a month, April the 8th. So a little less than a month now will have passed by the time we're on a month from now. But lots of people getting set, getting excited to go see where it's going to go see the total darkness. In Canada, the best places to be are sort of Sherbrooke, Quebec, Montreal, Kingston, Hamilton, Toronto will see parts of it. Miramichi down in New Brunswick, it'll cross over to Gander. It's quick. It's only like a minute and a half, maybe two and a half. I think 3.5 minutes in Sherbrooke is tops, Miramichi close behind. But they're expecting lots of people to come and have a look because it's going to be the first total solar eclipse that Canadians will have been able to see since 1979. So that goes back a long way. And we probably won't see another one for quite some time to come. You know, we always ask the same question, don't we? I mean, this is always the question that comes up, Kelly, about what equipment you should use to go out and watch an eclipse if you happen to be in the perfect viewing area. But it seems to me, I mean, when I was young, it was kind of these weird things that, you remember those long tubes that you could look into? What do we do now?
So now we actually have rather inexpensive eclipse glasses. So these are little paper glasses. They look like sunglasses, but they're importantly not sunglasses. They have filters in them that make the sun appear something like 1,000 times darker than it normally is, so you can safely watch the eclipse. So if you are in a location that only has a partial eclipse, you have to wear these eclipse glasses the entire time. If you are in the path of totality, you can take your eclipse glasses off during the total part of the eclipse. And as soon as you start to see just a little bit of the sun peek in, put your eclipse glasses back on.
Yeah.
If you don't have eclipse glasses, there's other ways of seeing the eclipse. You can make pinhole viewers. Also, what's really fun to do is to take a colander, like the thing you drain pasta with, and you can actually watch the sun shine through that, and you get little crescent suns on the ground. It's absolutely delightful.
Oh, wow. That would be cool. I was looking up the mythology of eclipses, of course. We you know, you're talking now about all the things that NASA is doing and all that scientists are doing to try and sort of take advantage of those brief moments to see more of the sun and learn things. But back in the day, I mean, an eclipse was a cause for much concern, if I remember, if I read it correctly.
Yeah, it was. But the cool thing about eclipses is that you actually don't need to have like a 3D model of the solar system in order to predict them. You basically just have to be able to count cycles. So people in ancient Babylon, people in ancient China, people in Mesoamerica were actually able to predict eclipses in advance and give people a warning about this, you know, ominous time that's about to come.
Yeah, there was a lot of beating of drums and so on to chase away bad things and so on. But the Greeks, ancient Greeks thought it portended really bad stuff, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it is kind of terrifying if you don't know what's going on. In the middle of the day, the sun just kind of disappears and it becomes night for a couple minutes and then it comes back.
Right. So you're all set for your Indianapolis trip. And I mean, when you look at the next one, I don't think will be for decades, right?
Exactly, yeah. It's something like the next total eclipse is 2044 in Western Canada and 2079 in the Maritimes. So I think this is the closest I will be to a total solar eclipse without having to travel to a far off location.
Right. Which by the sounds of your voice, you have done.
Actually, no, I haven't.
No?
So the last total solar eclipse, I stayed in Montreal. I was working at McGill, and I organized a viewing party for 30,000 people, which was fun. But this time, I want to see the total eclipse.
Yeah, you might as well take advantage of it. I mean, it is at times. I mean, I know sometimes this is an overwrought term, but it can be a once in a lifetime opportunity, right? And isn't that amazing, Kelly? Listen, have a great time in Indianapolis. We'll be watching out for you, and I'll be thinking of you on the 8th as we're all. I'll be out west, but we'll be watching social media to see all those great pictures.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for having me, and I'm glad to be able to talk a little bit about the eclipse with you.
When you get to be my age, certain things become clearer than ever. I know the American story. Again and again, I've seen the contest between competing forces and the battle for the soul of our nation. Between those who want to pull America back to the past and those who want to move America into the future. My lifetime has taught me to embrace freedom and democracy. A future based on core values that have defined America. Honesty, decency, dignity, equality. To respect everyone, to give everyone a fair shot, to give hate no safe harbor. Now other people my age see it differently. The American story of resentment, revenge, and retribution, that's not me.
Joe Biden delivering his State of the Union address last night. And let's be honest, this was a State of the Union address in name, but really it was the kickoff of his reelection campaign in reality. Because that's what it was. It was quite a partisan speech. I mean, you know, he was basically laying out his argument for another 4 years, which, I mean, now that Super Tuesday is done, it looks all but absolute, unless something out of left field happens, which it could. It looks like we're going to have a rematch of the 2020 election between Donald Trump and the president, Joe Biden. So last night, a lot of people were watching, and honestly, I think, you know, we were sort of, that was a bit of the substance of it, but I think a lot of people were just watching more for the style. I mean, it was like sort of thinking, I think even Democrats were a bit worried. There's been some concern about whether Joe Biden is in, I mean, no one questions his aptitude or his abilities, but is he up for another 4 years, right? I mean, I think that was the point. And this was him in the spotlight all by himself addressing Congress. You know, he was pretty up for it. There's no two ways about it. He did fire multiple broadsides at his quote-unquote predecessor without ever mentioning Trump by name.
Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault at home as they are today. What makes our moment rare is that freedom and democracy are under attack at both at home and overseas.
Indeed. Now, listen, this is a familiar playlist, right? I mean, what he was talking about was really his argument for re-election. And it was familiar to anyone who's listened to him talk a lot. These are the things they try to hammer out. And listen, they've been having trouble doing it. I mean, the American economy is in good shape, but people aren't happy for many of the same reasons that people aren't happy in this country. It's about the price of groceries. It's about affordability. It's about housing. There's a lot of things going on that people are just a little upset about or a lot upset about. And the first, where do you cast your glaze when you're upset? At the people in power, right? He did talk about some other stuff. I mean, a lot of this was taking shots at the Republicans and taking shots at Donald Trump. And he did actually, and one of the more impressive parts of all this is that he was sort of parrying when they were booing him, when the Republican Congress people were booing him, he was answering back. So it seemed like he was on his toes. He was certainly up for it last night. I mean, he was very energized. He talked a bit about Gaza. You know, the United States are going to try and carve out a sea route to deliver food and other aid to the Palestinians cut off by the war. He also continued to talk about support for Ukraine and his opposition to Russia and Vladimir Putin.
Now my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, do whatever the hell you want. That's a quote. A former president actually said that, bowing down to a Russian leader. I think it's outrageous. It's dangerous and it's unacceptable.
Yeah. So Biden was pretty fiery last night. Some people thought he was yelling a bit too much. But I mean, if eyes were on him to see if he had the fire in his belly, I think last night we saw that. Now, whether you want to, it's not for us to decide in this country, obviously, but whether Americans think he's still fit for the role, we'll see. I mean, there's a long way to go until, no, actually not even that long, but until November the 5th, but there we have it. The Republicans, of course, rebutted this, as they always do. They put up Alabama Senator Katie Britt. She's the youngest senator in the Senate right now. She's newly elected. Trump supported her. She called Joe Biden a dithering and diminished leader. And here's what she had to say.
Like so many families across America, my husband Wesley and I just watched President Biden's State of the Union address from our living room. And what we saw was the performance of a permanent politician who has actually been in office for longer than I've been alive. One thing was quite clear though. President Biden just doesn't get it. He's out of touch.
Now rebuttals are always tough. Because, you know, and she may have watched it in her living room, but they had her filmed in a kitchen, a very sterile looking kitchen by herself on the eve of International Women's Day. People were a bit upset about that. And even Republicans were like, oh, because it was a bit affected. That being said, I mean, they're never particularly good. So who knows how people took it. I mean, I think a lot of it, it's so divided now that I suppose people who want to see will see what they wanted to see. But one conservative podcaster said, Katie Britt is exactly the right pick for the response, but this is hard to watch. She's acting instead of speaking. And she was. But let's be honest, no one was really there to see the rebuttal. People wanted to see if Biden had the energy and the wherewithal to fight another election and to serve another four-year term. Did he succeed? Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta, and she joins me now. Andra, thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I can't remember a State of the Union address, and I was just watching it before the show came on last night, where there was as much anticipation, not about what was going to be said, but just about, it was a bit like going to see an artist perform, wondering if they could still hit the high notes. You know, it was interesting.
Well, this certainly was a make or break moment. It's not going to be the only make or break moment for President Joe Biden, because there has been a lot of media frenzy about his age and whether or not he is still mentally and physically up for the task of being president. He had very little margin for error. If he made a serious gaffe, if he had a mental block and froze during the State of the Union address, that would just make ads for the rest of this political cycle. And in particular, this is important, not so much because Republicans have been chiming this refrain for months, but because Democrats were starting to embrace it. And there were kind of grumblings and concerns about whether or not Biden was actually up for the task of an election cycle and a campaign this year. Most Democrats, based on what I've seen in the commentary and in social media, seem to be satisfied with Joe Biden's performance last night. And so you'll probably hear fewer complaints, fewer grumblings, fewer anonymous quotes to journalists talking about we don't think that Biden is up for the job based on that performance last night.
That's interesting you put it that way, because I think a lot of us watching would have thought, okay, he's out there to convince voters he's still up for the job. He's certainly out there to combat the narrative that the Republicans are putting forward. But I hadn't quite thought of it as being having to convince his own party that he was still up for it.
There were some elites who were starting to openly say things. So commentators on television, op-ed writers,
Right.
people who have had experience in politics before, who had, been saying that it was less than ideal to have an 81-year-old standard bearer. And so he had a lot to prove to them. He probably still has a lot to prove to people who could potentially be campaign volunteers and, other kind of unheralded but very important low-level campaign officials that he was worth campaigning for. And I think a lot of Democrats left that performance last night very confident that they could campaign credibly and fervently and enthusiastically for Joe Biden despite his age.
Yeah, what did you make of it? I mean, there's been volumes of commentary about how it went already, most of it about the style over the substance of what he had to say. But I watched it and it felt, I mean, he has a tendency sometimes to yell a bit when he wants to emphasize. He's always been that way. That's not new. But what did you make overall of his performance last night?
So in my world, the yelling was a big deal, and that was kind of a Rorschach test
Right.
for your prior partisan position taking. So my Republican friends, in particular, I got into a debate on social media with my former Sunday school teacher, actually,
Wow.
about whether or not Biden was screaming. And then there was this Democratic narrative that started that he was speaking with the fervor of a Baptist preacher.
Oh, wow.
And I wouldn't actually characterize Biden's cadence as being that of a Baptist preacher, but people kind of went there to kind of justify and to basically say that they agreed with how Biden presented himself. There were Democrats who actually wanted Biden to be aggressive,
Right.
in part because they view Donald Trump as an existential threat. And so they believe that you should make a response that's actually sort of equally full-throated to what they believe Donald Trump is putting out there. I think on the substance, this is part rhetorical and part substantive. Biden presented some really interesting contrasts. He talks about Trump. He doesn't mention him by name, but he usually referred to him as my predecessor or a previous Republican president.
Right.
And he talked about the contrast and even called Republicans out for aligning with this or enabling some of the things that Biden put together. So he invoked Ronald Reagan on the issue of Ukraine and said, Ronald Reagan would never have coddled up to Vladimir Putin in the way that Donald Trump has. He held Republicans to task for not passing the border bill that had been worked out with conservative Republicans and Democrats in the US Senate. Got a nod actually because they panned to Senator James Lankford, who had been
Right.
the chief Republican negotiator in the crowd. And so Lankford is normally pretty stoic as it is, but you could hear him saying, "This is true." As this is going on, you could see the banter. He tried to triangulate on the issue of immigration. So I have to admit, I was a little shocked when he actually used the term illegal as opposed to undocumented,
Yeah, he
which
hadn't used that before, had he?
Democrats, I mean, 20 years ago, everybody said illegal alien, but Democrats have shifted more towards referring to people as undocumented as opposed to referring to them as illegal. So he's using the language again, and then he tries to get ahead of the Laken and Riley issue. And you could argue how successful he was. He still kind of did get ahead of the issue and still was managed to own the floor, even though he was getting heckled by Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congresswoman from North Georgia.
Right.
So, I mean, you could see ways where he was drawing contrast. And then he actually, invoked his age at the end by taking it head on. And he actually hearkened back to the era in which he was born. So he's a member of the greatest generation by virtue of being born in 1942, compared to Donald Trump, who was a baby boomer. But by saying he was born at World War II, he's invoking that nostalgia of that being a time of unity where the greatest generation kind of pulled together and saved the world for democracy, and saying, look, that provides me a perspective and experience that's actually needed in these troubled times. I'm not sure everybody picked up on that, but rhetorically and substantively, he hit on issues that Democrats wanted him to hit on.
Yeah, it felt like he walked the tightrope. I mean, regardless of your politics, I think you noticed today with the Republicans, and we could talk a bit about the rebuttal, but there wasn't a lot of, I mean, Republicans today went back to attacking him for the usual stuff. They didn't talk much about what was done last night. It felt like there wasn't anything in there that they could extract and sort of hammer him with.
There wasn't a viral moment that could live on in infamy in a television ad or on social media. So the Trump, a Trump super PAC has put out an ad that's like a reel of Biden gaffes. And if you were going to update that ad, there really wasn't anything that you could pull from last night that could go into that highlight reel.
Andre Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. We're talking about last night's State of the Union speech and the fallout from it. Joe Biden, of course, was pretty fiery. Some people thought a little too fiery. Some people were happy to see that he was showed a lot of zest and fervor for the gig and looked like he could look like he was eager to fight another election and reside at the White House for another 4 years. Andre, one of the things that's been interesting as a Canadian is watching, I mean, by all markers, America's doing pretty well these days. I mean, the economy is in good shape. Unemployment numbers are out today. They seem really good. People aren't happy though, and it's showing up in the polls, and I guess that's part of the reason why Democrats were getting nervous, not just about Joe Biden's age, but about his approval ratings, which are low.
Yeah, I mean, so there are a number of factors to this. So one related to the economy, while the U.S. is in a better position economically relative to other places in the world, in the United States, we only sort of think about what we feel. And so for most people, they're still paying more for groceries. Mm-hmm. They've noticed that gas prices have hiked up in the last couple of weeks by, 10 or 20 cents. Mortgage rates are still high, and it's still really difficult for people to get into a first home. So there is still a bit of a malaise that is still the result of the inflationary period that we're coming out of. And so while it looks like the landing will be soft, we still haven't completely landed yet. And people are seeing that, despite any gains that they may have made in savings or any increases in their income, it's been eaten up because of these, because of these inflationary prices. And so one response or one explanation that has been put out there is that government spending, the Inflation Reduction Act, which was meant to be an infrastructure bill, a lot of the spending during COVID, has actually contributed to putting these types of inflationary pressures on the economy. And people are nostalgic for the days where we had these record low interest rates that were precipitated by the stock market crash and the housing crisis of 2008.
Right. Yeah.
And is thinking that those were better times. And so they think about what life was like before the pandemic, and they don't realize that it doesn't matter what party the president was after this, that given the things that happened during COVID, because they had to happen, because we were all trying to figure our way through that unprecedented crisis, that we were probably going to end up, in a position where things were going to be a little bit tough. And so we sometimes blame presidents for things that are outside of their control.
Yeah,
the other
indeed.
Thing, yeah, I mean, the other thing that we have to think about is partisan polarization is still rampant in the United States. And so you're not going to have Republicans begrudgingly say, Joe Biden was a good president, so I'm going to give him higher ratings. And there are people who are going to argue that Biden didn't do enough, right? Some of these people could stay home, and that could be a problem for Biden in a general election, but these folks would still be more inclined to support Biden, even if they're not going to give him high marks in an approval rating.
Yeah.
And so I think we haven't thought about that. And then finally, some of the issue is expectations and what people read into Joe Biden's 2020 candidacy. So some people read into his candidacy that when he said, I'm going to be a transitional president, that meant he was only going to serve one term. And so I think that there's some resentment about that. But also when he tried to present a diametrically opposed vision for America than Donald Trump was offering at that particular moment, right, when he was handling COVID in a very glib way and sometimes saying things that didn't make a whole lot of sense and seemed outright dangerous, he offered a sense of competence that I think some people read as he's going to fix government instantaneously, and two, he's going to make it look easy. And it turns out governing is hard. And we have seen the sausage being made, and we don't like what we see. And so Biden into the, you know, to some people has overpromised and underdelivered, despite the fact that legislatively, particularly in his first 2 years in office, he actually got more stuff passed through Congress than, you know, Donald Trump did. And so in terms of actually thinking about his effectiveness legislatively, he's actually much more effective than I think people give him credit for.
Yeah, it was interesting watching the State of the Union last night, really, because of it was quite a partisan speech as well, that it really felt like, okay, the election campaign starts now.
Well, it did. I mean, you know, this week in the Super Tuesday primaries, we saw both Democrats and Republicans lose competitors. So Nikki Haley dropped out of the race, pretty much clearing the field for Donald Trump to be able to win enough delegates to secure the nomination using next week's primaries, which include my own state of Georgia. And then this week, Dean Phillips dropped out of the Democratic race. So while Marianne Williamson is in, she is not going to be considered a serious contender for the presidency. And so we expect that Joe Biden is going to pick up enough nominees or enough delegates within the next couple of weeks to be able to be the undisputed nominee of the Democratic Party. Well, so we knew already as of Wednesday or Tuesday night that the race was largely set between these two. And so this was the coming out party, if you will, for Joe Biden. And, you know, this week they're both holding campaign events in Georgia. So on Saturday, they'll both be in the state holding.
In your backyard, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, I mean, the general election campaign is on.
Yeah. And it just strikes me that so few people, there's so many people where you are in America that just didn't want to see this rematch. They wanted something else. They didn't know what it was, but they didn't want to see this one again.
And, you know, it's also been very clear for a number of months that Joe Biden and Donald Trump are going to run against each other. And so we just all have to come to a place of acceptance that these are the two nominees and that we really are redoing 2020.
Andra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.